The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Are you recovering?
Of course I'm recovering. Are you recovering?
You know what? Nothing makes me smile like sunshine and warm weather.
Well, nabs and bourbon.
Oh, we'll talk about that in a moment.
Okay.
But it's a relief. We're finally seeing grass and sidewalks.
And many other things.
And many other things. Although you came into the studio bursting my bubble saying it's going to get cold again next week.
Well, it hasn't been opening day for baseball yet.
Oh, true that. Oh, that's like 3 weeks away, right?
Yep.
Well, you said Louisville, so let's talk about Louisville, okay?
Okay.
All right. So it was a whirlwind trip. You know, we left on Thursday. So Louisville had a nasty storm on Wednesday, evidently. It rained, and then it got icy, and then it snowed a foot. Well, for Louisville, it might as well have snowed 3 feet, 10 feet, because we drove down on Thursday, and while it was a pretty day, it was cold, it was cars everywhere. They were in the median, off to the side. They were buried in snow, but you couldn't tell because the roadways were clear. Then we got into downtown Louisville, and the streets were not plowed. It was just a disaster. Deliveries weren't made of food. The Starbucks in the convention center had this beautiful display of pastries, but they didn't really have any. It was unbelievable. But there was wine.
Good.
And there was beer. And I know you want to talk about bourbon, and we will talk about bourbon. We came back early Saturday evening. The show was excellent. If you'd like to see some really good coverage on the show, I would highly recommend Patrick Brady's Red Kite Prayer 6-part series, because my feeble attempts at blogging the show don't even begin to I don't know how he gets so much content up there so fast.
That's just one of the skills he has.
Well, it is a heck of a skill. He was also the head judge at the show, and I think he and his team did a really, really good job. He took the work very seriously, and along with the other judges, they really came up with some heartfelt choices. You know, they examined them. They spent a lot of time. There's always controversy, because I think subjective coverage is never without controversy. But I believe the explanations for each of his choices were enough to ensure a really good result. Really good result. The one award I would like to acknowledge at the show, although all the awards were well-deserved, was given to our friend and our recent guest, Rody Walter from Groovy Cycle Works. Remember him talking about his surfer bike that was going to hold surfboards? It won Best in Show.
Fantastic.
It did. It absolutely deserved it. It had that special rack that holds the client's surfboards. The Brooks saddle had been etched to a picture that Rody sent to this guy who is starting to etch saddles. I mean, this guy has a career coming up here. This is like his second or third career. Right down to the little label on the surfboard. It was just stunning. Here's what Patrick Brady had to say about the bike. This bike's achievement was so extraordinary and so well suited to its future life that only someone sleeping off a 3-week meth binge wouldn't be able to appreciate how rare a bike like this is. This bike is precisely the point behind NABS. It confirms my belief in the idea of commissioning a great bike and how that bike can be a reflection of you and your life beyond just your fit or component choices. This is the meaning of custom. It was stunning. just stunning. There was some controversy about a new builder's bike. It's still kind of roiling online. While not too many people noticed it at the show, Alan Abbott's Signorina, a carbon fiber frame shaped like a woman, stirred up a whole lot of upset on Facebook after the event. So in my opinion, this is my opinion, if the bike had been entered in a juried art show, and if Mr. Abbott had chosen not to add a rather demeaning survey to his website, he might have gotten away with his entry as object art, but he did add the survey. This wasn't a juried art show, and his depiction of the female form built into his bicycle the way it was raised the hackles of a lot of folks, especially some men, interestingly enough. My take on it, I just felt it was creepy and lewd.
Well, and we talked about this a little bit off the air before, and I've seen a couple motorcycle frames, and I sent you a couple of pictures that are disgusting when it comes to that. But I think it's a shame that everything that goes into what could be a beautiful frame may have gotten ruined simply because of his survey and the other things that he did.
Did he read the survey?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, anyway, I think the show was a great success. Next year, Minneapolis.
Well, it won't be any warmer than Louisville.
No, but I think it's a really good choice because the cycling culture of Minneapolis is excellent. And I think it's nice to move it a little more north.
Well, I think that's important that they do move it. And as it's going to continue to grow. And as it gets that much bigger, they're going to need to move around the country.
Want to hear my funniest story?
It's
not really funny. It was just weird. We needed to come home, as you know, on Saturday for a variety of reasons. And on our way out of town, we decided to stop to find some bourbon, right? For Brian. I don't drink bourbon.
Right.
Brian drinks bourbon. We're standing in this really nice liquor store. And by the way, there's a bourbon shortage in bourbon country. Seriously, Brian was looking for all, you know, he has this list of what he wants to try. They had two.
Did he go online when he got back in order to?
No, he didn't. No, you know, you can't buy bourbon. They can't ship it.
Really? You
can't?
No. Well, you can ship wine, I know.
Yes,
and
you
there's
can,
other
but
stuff.
You cannot
that
you can, ship
I didn't
bourbon.
Know that.
Yeah. So my cell phone rings. I'm standing in this store. My cell phone rings. And I see it's a Kentucky area code. And I'm like, all right, who the heck is calling me on a Saturday from Kentucky? We just left the convention center, right? Turns out it's Margaret, Mayor Fisher's secretary. She's going, where are you? Mayor Fisher wants to meet you and say hello. And I'm going, oh, damn. I said, I'll tell you where we are. We're standing in a liquor store trying to buy Kentucky bourbon. We're not at the convention center. We're already on our way home. I really feel horrible. She goes, oh, he's going to be so disappointed. But I did promise that if I go back to Kentucky, I will go through Louisville and I will stop by his city, which might actually be next month if I go to Rodney's Redbud Ride.
You didn't tell Brian that he had 80 different kinds of bourbon in his office, did you?
I did, but he wasn't in his office anyway.
Okay.
He was
so you
in
wouldn't have met him at the office.
No,
you would
no,
have met
no,
him
no,
at the
no,
convention
no,
center.
No,
okay.
Right. So it was a nice phone call. It made me feel really good that he thought enough of me, you know, to give me a call.
That's good.
All right. So should we get on with the show this week?
Yes.
Okay. I'm excited about this. My first guest is actually an Academy Award-winning director.
Really?
Yes, she is. In 2007, Toril Cove won an Oscar for her film, The Danish Poet. She does animated shorts. And this year, her animated short, Me and My Molten, you remember my mentioning that, was nominated for the coveted Oscar Award. Toril started out as an urban planner, big surprise, right? When she discovered she really loved animation, and the rest, as they say, is history. Numerous awards, and years later, she is still enamored of the art and craft of animated film. So I heard that title, as I told you originally, announced, and I knew right away that it had to be a Molten bicycle, which in this case it is. It didn't win the Oscar this year, but it definitely wins accolades for me for a most delightful and beautifully written, produced, and directed short film. So they sent me a link so that I could watch it. It's about 12 and a half minutes long, and it is just adorable. It is lovely. How the bike becomes the focus of the film is almost irrelevant to the overall enjoyment. It's the tale of three young sisters with very eclectic parents living a very modern life. So it's a great little film. So Toro will be with me in a moment. After a break, and we have lots of news this week, we're going to head down to Washington, D.C. to speak with Elizabeth Murphy. So the National Bike Summit just finished up. Thursday was the On the Hill day. So I asked Elizabeth to fill me in on the summit and what happened at the Women's Forum and what the ask was this year in light of a full Republican House and Senate. You know, we don't have much balance right. in the legislature. I also want to send out some good vibes to Kent Erickson. So Kent, as you know, was one of my panelists on the panel that I moderated, which we can talk about that another time. It was a fabulous panel, but there wasn't a lot of attendance. We really have to work out some of the kinks and when to have it, because it was really, really good. But Kent came home. He was supposed to be a guest this week, and he came home with the crud. High fever, chills, and he was not feeling well enough. His wife absolutely, you know, said, no, you're not going on the air this week. So he'll be coming up soon. So we wish him a speedy recovery. And as I said, we'll catch up with him in the not too distant future. So we're going to head on up to Montreal and speak with, I'm so excited, award-winning producer Toril Cove about her Oscar-nominated film, Me and My Molten. Toril, thank you for joining me on the show this week.
It's a pleasure.
It's an honor for me. And I want to congratulate you on your Academy Award nomination for Me and My Molten.
Thank you.
Well, you know, as soon as I heard the title, I knew it was about a molten bike. So I had to speak with you about it. But first, tell us a little bit about you and your background and your films, because this is not your first Oscar nomination. And in fact, you've already won an Oscar.
Yeah. So I'm an animator. I've been doing this for a while now, since the mid 90s, I guess. And I am Norwegian, but I live in Montreal in Canada, and I do really all of my work working with co-production between the National Film Board of Canada and Norwegian animation studio called Microfilm. And I have made three films. The first one was called My Grandmother Ironed the King's Shirt. And the second one was called The Danish Poet. And then there's this one called Me and My Molten. And basically, I'm kind of an old-fashioned animator. I draw in 2D, and my animation pretty much looks like my drawings.
It's adorable.
Thank you.
It's just adorable. So The Danish Poet is the film for which you did win an Oscar, but each of these stories is connected to you somehow. So, go ahead. Tell us a little bit about those connections.
Well, I would say yes and no. I mean, the Me and My Molten, my latest one, really is quite connected to myself. It is really almost like a little memoir from a little snippet of my life. But the two others are really, you know, they really are just made up stories. And in My grandmother, I in the King's Shirts, I'm using a character who's kind of a composite character of several little old ladies that I've known in my past, and my grandmother was one of them. It is based on something that she told us when she was a kid, which was that she had a job where she ironed the king's shirts. That's really the only part of that story that I didn't make up, other than the historical facts around it. Of course, you know, Norway was invaded by the Germans during the war. We did have war in our country. It was, you know, partly bombed very badly. So, I mean, all of the sort of the historical facts that I use as context for the story are true. But the little bit about my grandmother and the shirts that she may or may not have ironed really is the only connection to me. And in The Danish Poet, I had originally set out to make a film that was quite biographical about how my parents met. But halfway through the writing of the story, I decided I didn't really want to use anything that was actually true. So I just wrote it. So in The Danish Poet, there's absolutely nothing in that story that has anything to do with my life, other than the fact that it takes place in Norway. That's it really. Like I said, the Me and My Molten is based on a period of my life when I was quite young and my parents were quite young, and you know, that one is kind of true.
What's interesting is you didn't actually start out as a filmmaker and an animator, and even though you probably drew and sketched as, you know, all your life, you started out as an urban planner.
Yes, I did. I mean, I think it was probably because, I mean, my parents were architects, and I think it was just like that kind of profession was something that was very familiar to me. There were all kinds of friends of the family who were also architects and planners and engineers, and I just felt like this was comfortable. So I chose it really partly because it was the only thing that I felt that I really knew anything about. But then I realized, I studied architecture, and that was just a bad idea for me to do it all. I'm really not suited for it. Urban planning, I worked as a planner for a while, but it wasn't quite me. You know, I didn't really feel like it was something that I was particularly good at. And part of it I enjoyed, but part of it also just kind of felt like I was doing a job and not really putting my heart into it. So I had a kind of fairly late life, sort of restructuring my career, and started animation.
We all do those changes. I didn't start out as a radio host, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's kind of healthy, actually. I mean, you can do more than one thing, you know?
I would agree. I have a question about how you actually found this new profession. I think I read that you started watching films and
yeah.
All of a sudden, okay, tell us a little bit about that story, because it's a nice story.
Well, it was I was having a year. I had a job that I basically, you know, I lost it and I couldn't find a new job. It was in Montreal in the 90s, and the job market was very bad for people in my profession. And I was lucky because I had unemployment insurance, and part of my job as somebody who receives insurance for unemployment was not only to try to find work, but if that was not successful, try to think of something else that I could do. So I spent a fair bit of time just kind of researching what might I do if I didn't do urban planning or something architecture related, but I could use my education, and I could draw, which I guess I just always had kind of a talent for it. And I also always really liked just kind of write and make up stories in a kind of a comic strip kind of way. So I freelanced a bit as an illustrator, but it wasn't, I think it takes a long time to build up enough of a reputation in order to actually make a living doing that. But then I started looking at film and at animated film. And of course, the National Film Board of Canada has its headquarters here in Montreal, and they used to have this giant library right downtown where you could go and rent films or just watch them right there on the premises. So I did that a lot. So I just went there and I watched films, you know, one after the other. And I found it kind of fascinating because it looked like, well, first of all, it looked like there were so many different ways of doing it, so many different ways of telling a story, and so many different visual expressions that you could use in animation. And I kind of started looking at it as something that I could probably do with a bit of training, that at least it was worth a try. And then I actually called somebody who worked at the National Film Board at the time, and I just asked if I could meet her and talk to her about this, and she said yes, and that is kind of what made the ball kind of rolling. She was very helpful, and I went back to school for a year, and then I got a job at the National Film Board, and then I just started pitching stories there, and that's basically how I ended up doing what I do.
I'm speaking with Toril Cove. She is the director and animator of the Academy Award-nominated film Me and My Molten, and that's what I want to know. How did you know about Molten? How did you come to using a Molten bicycle? I mean, it's a British bike. I know a lot about the bike, and you either have one or you know about it somehow.
Well, no, I mean, it's exactly like in the film. My parents bought one for us.
Oh, it is like that. Okay.
Yeah, it is. That really happened. That really happened. And it happened pretty much like that. You know, we really wanted a bike and it took forever to get one. And they kept talking about this bike that they had to special order from a different country. And it was like, what the heck are they getting us? You know? And yeah, so that's, and there was one other Molten bike in our town, and it belonged to my dad's colleague at work. And I guess my parents just really wanted a bike like that, and because they thought it was so incredibly cool and nifty, you know, they kept it a secret so that it could be this big, wonderful surprise.
Well, it's pretty nifty.
It's pretty nifty, all right. It was a great bike. I mean, we grew very fond of it. We became, all three of us, became very loyal to it.
So you are the middle child of three girls.
Yes, I am. I mean, all of those things in the film are true. My parents are architects. I am the middle child. I have two sisters. We have those weird chairs. My grandmother lived with us. My dad had a mustache. I mean, it really is pretty much a true story.
And you had a friend named Beatrice with an S?
Well, her name. Well, actually, her name was something else. That part of the story is really the only thing that I had that weren't true. I didn't want to use their real names because I had, in a sense, rewritten their lives quite a bit. So
Yeah, that's true.
I didn't want to be quite so literal with them.
It was an interesting story. In such a short film, it's only 12 minutes and something. There was a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, there is. Like, I packed a lot of stuff into that film.
You did. So, do you still ride a bike? Do you have a bike? You live in a part of the world where there is good cycling.
You know, I don't ride a bike. I've lived in Norway on and off the past 15, 20 years, and I like to spend summer there. So I ride a bike in Norway because we typically, when we're there, we live outside the city, and it feels safe. Right now, I live downtown Montreal, and I bought a bike many, many years ago, and I used it, I think, twice, and it just scared. It just really scared me. I didn't feel safe at all, and it's just. I think if you grow up riding a bike in Montreal, you become sort of bicycle street smart on the streets here, and it's I'm sure quite safe. It really is a bicycling city. We have, we have the rental Bixi bikes, and we don't have tons of bike paths, but we have some pretty good ones. But I haven't ridden a bike in Montreal in ages. I just don't. I'm too scared.
We hate hearing that. We hate hearing that, but you know what? I totally
Well, I mean,
understand
it's
it.
different everywhere, I mean, it's just I'm not afraid in Norway. In Norway, I ride it all the time. I think it's just a question of the sort of the intensity of traffic that you're comfortable with and what you're used to and how much you trust your reflexes and all that. And I am sort of I'm past being willing to take that chance. And truth be told, I don't really need to bike much because I live so close to everything that I need. So I can pretty much walk or hop on the bus to everywhere. So that's probably not what you want to hear, but that's
I think it's awesome. You know what? It's a choice you make, and I think your choice is just fine. I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm
So
glad to hear
what are
that.
you working on currently? Is there another film in the works?
I wouldn't exactly say that it's in the works, but there will definitely be another one. And it's just I'm not I'm still kind of writing on it, and I have I'm kind of juggling a few stories actually. I'm trying to figure out if I can make it into one film or if I should divide it up into several ones, or I'm not quite sure what. So the only thing that I feel comfortable saying about this film is that I think while my three other films have been set in Scandinavian countries, I think this one is going to be a kind of a local Montreal story.
Nice. So I have one last question, and that is how people can see me and my Molten, my listeners. Jennifer was kind enough to send me a link so that I could watch it so I knew what I was talking about with you today. But where will the film be shown? I mean, it is obviously an important film. It was nominated for an Oscar. Where could they see it now? Is there a way to get
Well,
to
you know
it?
what? I'm not sure exactly where you can see it. There was a period where it was screened with the other nominated short films in a theater. There was kind of like a package made for actual movie theaters where it was screened. So I'm not sure if they. I'm not sure. Maybe they did that in connection with the Oscars. Maybe not. I'm actually not sure, to tell you the truth. I think my two other films, I think you can find them on the National Film Board's website. The two older ones, and the new one is not. I don't think it's available to stream for free anywhere right now. But I know it's. You can download it from iTunes. So that's the only site where I know of that you can actually see it right
Okay,
now.
well, that's good enough. We're all subscribers to iTunes. That'll work. Well, I really, really appreciate you taking time to talk with me, and I wish you a lot of good luck with your future films. I certainly enjoyed this one a lot.
Thank you very much, Deanne. It's a pleasure talking to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Toral Cove joined me from her home in Montreal, I guess part-time home, because she spends a lot more of her time in Norway, too.
That's a really neat story.
this film is adorable. I am telling you, the three-legged chairs, you know, the grandmother. So one of the things the grandmother told these girls, these three little girls, was if they didn't argue, she paid them at the end of the week, each week. And that they when they take their clothes off at night, they needed to fold them and put them on the chair, because if there's a fire and they have to run out, they don't want to run out naked. I mean, it's just, there are so many little details in this film. I watched it twice to make sure I didn't miss anything. It was so, so nice.
We'll see what we can do to find where people can actually watch it, and we'll see if we can get that put in the show notes.
If it's on iTunes, Me and My Molten by Toral Cove, that might be one way. I highly recommend it. It was just such a fun film. So we need to take a break. And then we're going to do some news. And then we're going to go to Washington, D.C. and learn about the Bike Summit. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cycliste. I'm your host, Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And it's time for some news.
Yes, it's always time for news.
Yeah, well, there's always a lot of cycling news in the spring, especially in the spring. So let's start with you.
This is staying in Ohio. I got news from Laura over at Velo Femme Litster, the women's cycling team, that Corey Green of the Ohio Cycling Association and women's cycling teams from Cleveland, Cincinnati, Columbus, and Dayton have come together to organize Ohio's first ever women's race series.
Oh, nice.
Series was created to promote and grow the competitive environment of women's cycling and to encourage team participation in the series. The competition will be based on collegiate omnium rules, and the winning team will be scored on their best 6 of 8 races. The first race actually starts April 12th down in Zanesville. For more information, if you're interested, you can go to the Facebook page of OWRS Series, and that's the Ohio Women's Race Series. Or if you just do a search, I'm sure that you'll be able to find it, and all the information is on their Facebook page.
And how many races are in the series?
They will have 8 races.
Wow, that's ambitious.
Yep.
Wow, that's awesome.
With the last race on July 12th, the Women's Midwest Road Race Championship.
Yeah, I was just going to say it would culminate with the championship. That's great. Okay, this comes from my pet peeve department.
That's a big department, isn't it?
Well, it is. And we've had this particular conversation before. Spectators getting in the way of cyclists. Rowney taken out by spectator in Drenth finish. This comes from Velo News competitor, of course. A spectator caused Australian Lauren Downey from Velocio SRAM to crash at the finish of the Ronde van Drenth race in the Netherlands on Thursday. Video footage shows a man standing against the barriers on the right side of the finish chute. He appears to have reached out and grabbed Rowney's handlebars. She went tumbling to the ground right before the finish line. Rowney was sprinting for the win in a group of 8 riders at the end of the 138.2-kilometer race. From that group, Wiggle Honda's Giorgia Bronzini was the winner. Valentina Scandalara, Orica AIS, was in second. And Annemiek van Vleuten, I hope I said that correctly, from Bigla, was finishing third. After the race, Velocio SRAM tweeted, "At Lauren Rowney, involved in a crash in the last 50 meters, but is up and walking away." But the whole thing is really annoying to me.
The guy was actually over a barricade. It's not like you were just standing on the side of the road. He had to make a physical attempt to hop over the barricade and get in the way and
grabbed her handlebars. I mean, what are people thinking? Would you step in front of a race car? Oh, that would be okay.
Well, over there, that's a different issue in Europe with rally cars and things.
Okay. All right, next.
So, in my daily fun-searching the Twitters, Chris Froome did a little question-and-answer bit on Twitter, and this article is from Cycling Weekly. The questions ranged from the banal bacon sandwich or red or brown sauce to the controversial. Among the answers, Froome said that an attempt at the hour record may be on the cards, and he thought Bradley Wiggins had a good chance of winning Paris-Roubaix. He also revealed who it was that first coined his nickname of Froome Dog. It was former teammate Russell Downing. But here's my favorite part. When it came to asking the question of, what do you think about Mondori testing positive, because he was just tested recently, his response was, what an idiot. That's my quote of the week. That might be the quote of the year so far.
It might be the doping quote of the year.
It's so honest and it's so straightforward. And
what an idiot.
So he's up on the top of the list with that response.
Well, just an aside about the Twitters, I probably got 24 Twitters with Gen Z this week.
Yeah, Gen Z, he's busy.
He's busy. He's tweeting his little brains out, and they're all funny. He's funny.
He's got too much time on his hands. When he can post pictures of his rabbits and his kids going to school, he's got to start doing some more stuff.
Well, stuff is coming. Remember, he's Mr. Amgen Ambassador.
Yes.
He'll be fine. Here we go. Recall number one, SRAM recalls Zip 88 hubs. SRAM has recalled about 12,000 Zip 88 hubs after reports of hub flange ring failures. Now, other hubs in the past have had these problems. You know, the flange breaks off, and it's not a happy thing. The CPSC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, announcement describes the hubs as follows. Quote, the aluminum shell is silver. The outside flange ring is gray aluminum in the standard option and blue, gold, gray, pink, or red in the ZTEC options. The diameter of the two clinch nuts is approximately 1 inch. The first version of the 88 hub is the only one affected by the recall. The first version has the Z logo on the flange ring. The other versions, not affected by the recall, do not have the Z logo on the flange ring. The hubs were sold in 5 bike brands and sold separately. The 5 brands that outfitted bikes with these hubs are Specialized, Giant, Felt, Orbea, and Cannondale. Items were sold between October 2008 and December 2010. A full list of affected models is available on the CPSC website. Consumers are advised to stop using the recalled hubs immediately and contact SRAM for a replacement. You can call between 9 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Thursday. It's 800-346-2928 or 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on Friday. Or you can visit SRAM.com or Zip.com and click on recall information for more details. So even though these hubs were produced now, we're looking at 5 years ago, you know, if you haven't crashed those wheels, take them back, because you don't want to be riding if your hub flange breaks.
No.
Okay, good. That's Diane's wheel good advice this week.
Wheel good advice.
Wheel good advice.
Last week's news was bourbon and nabs. This week's news was the announcement of the new Apple Watch that recently came out. And how does that relate to us? Strava already announced that they have an app for it.
Of course they do.
Yes. So the list of features for the Apple Watch: intuitive on-wrist display that you can track your performance in real time while keeping your phone tucked away. So you don't have to have a phone. You can just look at your watch. Real-time segments, so you can get alerts and elapsed time warnings. Weekly training progress at a glance. Immediate hands-free results. Fast transitions between ride and run modes and several other things. The baseline Apple Watch is going to start at around $350. And then, of course, they do have the $13,000 to $15,000 gold watch. I don't think we're going to see many cyclists wearing those.
You never know.
Well, I'd love to sell them a bike if they're going to buy that watch. That'd be the bike I'd love to sell them. But my question is, I wonder how many people are actually going to move to a device like this, whether it's from another company like Google or something else. We have the Fitbits. We have everything else.
Well, remember we spoke with Celine Yeager last week. Once again, she came out with a really interesting article for bicycling called Beat the Heat, Even When It's Still Cold. And it's about heat acclimatization training, which can make you a better rider regardless of the temperatures. You can do it in the winter no matter where you live. So I'm like, okay, let's see. I'll bite. What's this one about? Well, what it's about is a competitive racer with Back Bay Cycling who lives in Boston. His name is Michael Whistle, a place where average temperatures for winter, as we know, and especially this year in Boston, not only were the temperatures impossibly cold, but they had more snow than anything else, like way over the rooftops. So as a hardy New Englander, harsh winters don't keep him from training, but they used to hurt him during spring races in the southern locales where suddenly he's going into 100% humidity, 85 degree weather, you know. So he said the first time it really hit him was the Transylvania mountain bike epic. Here's what they say that you should do, and that is you put on more clothes and train inside. Make the room that you're training in stifling hot and train in it. And I'm like, wow, it's like Bikram yoga, hot yoga.
That's exactly
right?
What I was
exactly.
thinking.
Exactly, I know. So it says heat acclimatization can have huge benefits. In a study published in March 2015, Medicine and Science and Sports and Exercise, researchers reported that a group of trained cyclists who performed a 43-kilometer time trial in both cool, 46 degrees, and hot, 98 degrees, conditions finished a whopping 11 minutes slower when they raced in the heat. But after 2 weeks of heat training, those same riders nailed their PR on the same time trial despite the oppressively hot conditions. So the article is in Bicycling Magazine. It is about how to train in the cold for when it's hot. I just think it's interesting because I think that's a big issue for people who travel to ride and race.
We do all kinds of other training, but the temperature training isn't something I think that a lot of people think of. I know in rowing all winter long, we're training, but we certainly don't turn up the heat. Maybe that's something that
we
should all take
about.
Yes. So as we talked earlier, everything's starting to melt and we're starting to see a little bit of grass and we're starting to see everything else. I found a nice article on globalnews.ca. Is this your bike? Downtown streets littered with abandoned bicycles.
Instead of abandoned cars?
This is abandoned bicycles. And this is apparently in downtown Toronto, they're having problems with dozens of bikes that just sort of appeared out of nowhere. They're eyesores, potential hazards, and take up space where bikes could be locked up. But they're also mysteries. How is it that so many people abandon bicycles on the street? If they're unwanted by their rightful owners or left there by thieves, why are they locked up? Now, I don't know a thief that would ever lock a bike up and actually leave it. Maybe he stole it or she stole it and didn't like it. And so apparently they have this every year. And Mark Romero of Cycle Toronto, a group that advocates for cycle-friendly city, blames bike abandonment on neglect and apathy. He said many people in the downtown core with no space to store a bicycle for the winter will simply lock it up somewhere outside. As parts go missing or the bike suffers damage, the owner figures the bike isn't worth saving, so they simply just leave it. So last year, Toronto removed 900 bikes off of downtown sidewalks. Now, that was all year. That wasn't just from the melt, but
even so, 900 bikes? That's a lot of bikes.
That's a huge number of bikes. I have an idea. If we can talk to the folks in Toronto and bring it down here, you remember we did a story last week where 48% of people in the United States don't have access to a bike?
Yes.
Bring them down here and we're going to start sticking them in garages.
We'll just give them away. Well, the other thing that I see, which is interesting, is remember stolen bikes often end up in police
impound. Yeah.
And you know what the police usually do is auction them off.
Right.
But why would an owner of a bike who already, it's not like it's stolen, would already know where it is? That just somehow, the whole thing doesn't make sense to me. 900 bikes is a lot of bikes. I'll bet there'll probably be more this year.
I'm sure with all the snow and everything else that we've had. Now, it's not like they see the bike and they take it away. The one thing that they made clear is they tag it and put a 14-day notice on. So it's there for 2 weeks before they actually will haul it away.
Put a boot on it.
Kind of, yeah. I guess that would be...
I'm going to boot your bike if you don't move it. Wow. So they're basically on the sidewalk.
Yeah, or just strapped up somewhere.
All right. This is also from Velo News, but it was one of the big stories this week. The UCI releases the CIRC report on doping governance, and I don't want to say much about it. I think it's a 227-page report, but one sentence summed it up for me. And that was the result of a year-long investigation. The report paints a thorough portrait of extensive doping, cover-ups, conflicts of interest, ineffectual leadership, infighting, wasted resources, and poor governance. What the hell else do you have to say? It's like throw out the baby and the bath and let's start over. This is, I mean, really, 200, they didn't need 227 pages to say that. That was pretty obnoxious.
I haven't seen one article or one comment anywhere that says, oh, gee, it's all untrue.
Nobody has refuted it. You know what? Nobody's surprised by it either.
No, and I think that's, well, it was let's,
a foregone conclusion.
Let's be positive and let's assume that
something good will come out of it.
That word, that we're going to move forward with this.
So, let's be positive.
This is from the daily UW.com. UW, University of Washington, mailing service has introduced bicycle delivery. The first week of March marked the launch of a new bicycle delivery program for the UW mailing services, which provides internal campus postal service. Student, faculty, and staff can send mail and small packages to UW departments or a recipient with a UW box number for free. So bike delivery is another step toward becoming environmentally conscious, according to the mailing service department, which has been making continuous improvements towards a more sustainable campus. Now, it uses hybrid and electric trucks, and the trucks take care of the bulk and the big stuff. The bicycles are going to be used mostly in the afternoon now when a lot of the lighter mail is going back and forth. So another good use.
You knew that I was going to talk about this, and you wanted to know if it was in Roswell, New Mexico.
Well, you said Roswell.
I did. And there's a reason for that. If you're looking for something to do next month, this came through on our Endurance Sports Wire, which is sent over every week. The Cycling Festival in Roswell returns for the 14th year in April, but it's Roswell, Georgia. Craft beer tasting and mountain bike races added to Roswell's Cycling Festival. Criterium, second stop for USA Crits Speed Week Series. So, organizers of the Roswell Cycling Festival have announced a new lineup of activities and partnerships for the 14th annual event scheduled for April 25th and 26th. Hennessy Jaguar Land Rover Centers returns this year as the presenting sponsor for the festival. Mountain bike races have been added at Big Creek Park leading up to the featured road races, and in addition, a craft beer tasting will be part of the popular historic Roswell Criterium event on Sunday in historic Roswell with 11 participating restaurants. Sounds like a Cleveland.
Yes,
you
it
know,
does.
Cleveland is all about food and beer, right?
Yep.
Roswell Cycling Festival has become more than a pleasant afternoon under the shade of trees in historic Roswell for bicycle races. It has become a showcase for the city as a bicycle-friendly community and a showcase for the city as a dining and shopping destination. Bike Roswell and corporate partners like Hennessy Land Rover and Hennessy Jaguar have helped this event continue to grow, said Roswell Mayor Jerry Wood, who inspired a local bicycle club in 2002 to host the inaugural event. So it's been going on. This is, as I said, the 14th year. You know it's spring when the Roswell Cycling Festival returns. This event is special because people of all ages can enjoy a variety of activities throughout the weekend. That's really cool. The Jaguar and Land Rover are big sponsors. I like that. Those are kind of like sexy names, you know, to associate with bicycling, yeah? So it's RoswellCyclingFestival.com if you are interested. It will benefit the Bike Roswell, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization promoting safe cycling in the city. Yep, I'm up for that.
So I have one that ties in with this, and it also ties in with what Celine did about, you know, hot training. 11 tasty summer beers for post-ride recovery.
Oh, there you go.
Bicycling.com. Summer can be tough on hopheads. A good pail often packs a thicker body and more malt to help the balance of the truckloads of hops that craft brewers pour into India pale ales and similarly hoppy beers. Twilight Summer Ale, while infused with biting citrus hop characters, still holds a light enough body to quench the thirst in an oppressively hot weather. And even if nature hasn't turned up the thermostat, the gentler 5% ABV, most pale ales and IPAs can hit up to 7%, make for a great afternoon barbecue beer that won't send you to bed early. Our staff tasters say crisp grapefruit and pine hop are very drinkable. So, they show 11 beers here that all a little bit different that might be interested, and they're from breweries all around the country, and I'm sure in a lot of places like Wisconsin or Ohio, you're going to find something that's very similar. So if you're looking for something out on the patio and you're just not quite sure what ale to go for, bicycling.com has the beer for you.
Wow. Well, on that refreshing note, I think we are going to remind you once again that you're listening to the Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to head on down to Washington, D.C., and we are going to speak with Elizabeth Murphy from the League of American Bicyclists. Elizabeth, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. I know you're about to go into a congressional reception. Tell us what that's going to be like.
That's right. It's sort of the end of the summit. A little bittersweet, but it's always a lot of fun. We have a crowd come to the Dirksen Senate Office Building, and we sort of corral folks to celebrate the day on the Hill and talking with legislators about the benefits of biking in their communities. And we usually have a lawmaker to stop by and say a few words in support of our causes.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Women's Forum? The theme was Bikes Plus Women Leaders Equal Big Ideas. What came out of the Women's Forum this year?
So this was the fourth annual Women's Forum, which kicks off the full National Bike Summit. We had about a little over 350 people come out. And so we've talked a lot about sort of the basics of, you know, there is a gender gap in bicycling. What are we going to do about it? And the Women Bike program from the League is really aimed at gender parity in biking and getting more women riding. But we wanted to dig a little deeper this year and sort of look at the root causes of why that gap exists. And one of those things is leadership and women not being in leadership roles in places where, in the bike movement, for example, why that is, what we could do for that to change, and how the movement could benefit greatly from that change, and sort of working with male allies that see sort of how that could really be a benefit to the movement at large. So we had a lot of great speakers focusing on leadership primarily, but we had talked a lot about gender really as well. We had a great panel about sort of, you know, what is the definition of a woman, thinking about trans issues and race and class. So a lot of deep thinking went on, and we had a lot of fun as well.
You know, when you think about cycling, we think about white men. So
Right. When
it comes to women, I know there are several large African-American groups, especially in Washington, D.C. There's a really, really nice group, as I remember, down there. There's one out in California. But I'd like to see, I think, more women just riding. I don't care about, you know, the orientation or the color of their skin or anything like that. I just care that more women are on bicycles. What did you discuss about children? Anything about children this year?
Yeah, we had a little bit. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to go to every session. Yeah, in the past we've certainly brought, and this year as well, talking about the role of motherhood and how mothers statistically make a lot of decisions regarding the children, primarily in this context, transportation, what children are eating, what activities they're involved in. And so, you know, if we're looking at growing the number of women riding, we need to have youth and children who see it as a safe and accessible activity for them, a lifelong activity. And so obviously women have a big role to play in that regard.
Would you characterize the Women's Forum as a big success this year? It was a big success right from the beginning, as I remember.
Yeah, you know, it's always so full of such energy and excitement. And I think it's just there's a certain feeling and buzz about it that just has a certain magic that I think really carries throughout the year as we keep thinking and talking about these issues.
So let's switch over to the actual large summit where attendees, you know, actually get the tools they need to go up and speak with their legislators. How many attendees were there this year? Do you know?
Yeah, we had about 650 people come to D.C. this year. We had 49 states and the District of Columbia represented, which is great to see, especially on lobby day. You know, folks are seeing people walking around with their bike pins everywhere. So
that's right.
Good to show that, you know, it's not just an urban thing. It's not just a rural thing. It's not just this or that. It's the constituency is diverse and broad and all over the United States.
Well, I have to ask the question, which state was not represented?
That would be North Dakota, unfortunately.
Really? That's interesting. Who would have thought that?
Unfortunately, and, you know, things happen with scheduling and weather and such, but yeah, we were happy. We'll hope to have them next year, and we're happy to have everyone else represented.
Were you able to see Congressman Blumenauer, one of my all-time favorite guys?
You know, the real bummer this year is that the House is on break, and so the vast majority of representatives are back in their home districts. So Representative Blumenauer, I don't think has missed a summit in many years. So he sent us a very kind and encouraging video that played at the very beginning of the opening address of the summit. So we still were able to get some of his spirit and that excitement infused.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Murphy. She is a representative of the League of American Bicyclists, and we're talking about the National Bike Summit that's just wrapping up. Both the House and Senate are in the hands of one party now. Now it's all Republican. Did it change the way the work was presented and the approach you took going up to the Hill this year?
Yeah, you know, I spoke with Karen Whitaker, our Vice President of Government Relations, who's really our person, boots on the ground here in Capitol Hill, talking to legislators and staff, and really has a sense of what's going on. And she said, you know, bicycling at the end of the day is a bipartisan issue. We had folks talking Republicans, Democrats, everything in between today, and there were a lot of positive conversations. And I think we recently heard from Senator Jim Inhofe, who is the head of the Senate Environment Committee, and he's typically very fiscally conservative and hasn't necessarily been a champion of bicycling in the past. And he said, you know, while I don't like to spend money, I think funding for bicycling and walking is essentially an inevitability moving forward. So that's a really good sign. And I think we have plenty of Republican champions in both chambers of Congress. So I think bicycling is really a great unifier in that way.
That's interesting that somebody who normally would say we're not spending a dime for walking or riding is seeing an inevitability. I think that's kind of an interesting approach. I like that. What was your ask this year up on the Hill? What were you asking for when you knocked on those doors?
So we had three basic questions. The first we ask every year is, will you support bicycling in the next year, in the next several years? Just getting taking a temperature of that member's thoughts on the issue. And then we're also focused on funding and safety. And so there's a bill in the House right now called the Vision Zero Act, which is focused on safety and is really attempting to reorient our discussion about roadway deaths, roadway safety. It basically says any roadway death is unacceptable, and we need to do everything we can do to ensure that that number is zero.
Who introduced that bill?
That was Representative Blumenauer.
Of course. Of course.
And, you know, there was one other, and I apologize, I don't know off the top of my head, who co-sponsored with him.
Sometimes Doris Matsui gets involved with these, so I didn't know if maybe she was involved, but I think it's awesome. And the Secretary of Transportation has sort of a vision for zero tolerance of zero, you know, deaths and accidents. Yeah,
he has a Toward Zero Deaths initiative as well, and he's been challenging mayors to take an interdisciplinary approach to their roads and to their environments. So that's been great to see this year as well.
And what was the third ask?
So the third is a bill that was just introduced in the Senate this week, in fact. And, you know, we have the Federal Transportation Bill reauthorization looming.
Yes, indeed.
Money runs out in May. So people are really scrambling and trying to do a lot of work here on the Hill to get something nailed down. But This bill really is focused on ensuring that money stays and so that money is better able to get in the hands of those locally, and so they can be making the decisions about how it's used. So that's really what we want to see. You know, if folks are able to tap this federal money, then they're able to use it in their context. So that's great.
Anybody have any idea of whether a comprehensive transportation bill will be brought up to the House this year and perhaps even sent for approval?
Yeah, so I got the chance to walk around with different Bike Summit attendees and their constituent meetings with some of the senators today. And, you know, people are really, you know, we've seen a lot of gridlock in Congress, but people are really focused on this and they want to get it done. No doubt about that. But on the House side, Chairman Schuster of the Transportation Committee, TNI, Transportation Infrastructure, really wants to get this done, and he wants to do it in a bipartisan fashion. And so I think if they're able to agree on something, I think he is gung-ho to get it through and get it done. But, you know, that's certainly not a sure bet. We're watching closely.
The last thing I want to ask you about is what you think attendees will be taking back to their communities. That, you know, these people represent, you know, their bike cycling communities, statewide and then countywide, citywide. What was the big takeaway, do you think, for everybody this year?
I think the summit is always has a lot of energy around it, because in a lot of communities, you may be the only person who's, you know, knocking on doors, talking to your local elected government, and really advocating for biking and walking and places that are easy to do so and safe to do so. And so when everyone's able to get together, I think it's really energizing and unifying, and that, you know, they're not working in isolation. There is a larger movement here that's supporting them, and so really wants to celebrate all the work that they're doing, because they're really doing the work that impacts everyday people. So I think just that feeling of being a part of a greater something and seeing their legislators evolve and be very well versed in the issues and have you know, similar opinions and feelings. That's always great to see.
I really appreciate you taking time. I know you're rushing to get into the congressional reception, and I'm glad to have been able to talk with you about the summit this year. For more information about the Bike Summit, you can log on to bikeleague.org. Elizabeth Murphy, have a great night, and I'll talk to you again.
Sounds great. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Elizabeth Murphy joined me from just getting ready to hop on into the Congressional Bike Summit.
I have a question. You've been to these events before.
I have.
Is it more important to get things done at the national level, or do we get more accomplished for cycling at the local level?
It's an interesting question, and one I'm not sure that I'm qualified to answer, other than to say it is always, always interesting to be face-to-face with your legislators, because they are local. I mean, Senator Sherrod Brown, for example, is still our senator, and he represents everybody in Ohio. My congressional representative when my store was out in Chesterland was Steve LaTourette. And at first, we really, you know, we butted heads about a lot of things. And then we became friends because he realized that this was an issue that affected his constituents. So I think you can get things done there, but you still need to come home and do the, as she says, boots on the ground work.
Would it be fair to say then that you need to go to Washington and you need to communicate with our representative so we can get the money?
Well, the money's always going
to
be the issue.
We have to have the system in place here.
Yeah, what are you going to do with it? Sure. What are you going to do with it?
Right.
And that's always a question. Infrastructure is a huge concern. Everybody's worried about bridges and roads and railroads and everything else. And cycling is such a tiny part, but it is growing, and it is growing positively. We hope you enjoyed our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you can, and it's sunny and bright like it is here in Northeast Ohio, go out and go for a ride. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.